how did you become a naturopathic physician?
Well, it started in childhood. Growing up, my mother's very nutrition oriented, health food stores. You know, occasionally she'd shop at, you know, go straight to the farms in Northern Virginia and, you know, buy their whatever the local current crop was. And anyway, she took me to a homeopathic doctor. I had plantar warts, about 12 on the bottom of my foot. And, you know, I was like only 12 then. I just go wherever my mom's going to take me. I got
one of those plantar warts, too, on the bottom of my feet. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. As I said, I went into the doctor feeling fine and came out hardly able to walk.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so my mom took me to a homeopathic doctor. He was an MD, medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And he sat down, we talked for like half hour. You know, he just wanted to get to know me. He was like talking about my likes and dislikes, you know, about school. Just And after a half hour, I was like, well, do you want to look at my foot?
Yeah, right.
And so he did. And he gave me one dose of a homeopathic medicine. And anyways, they were all gone the next day.
Wow, I would have preferred that than having them scraped off my foot with some kind of serious surgery, which happened to be as a kid.
Right. Yeah, there's no burning or freezing them. So anyways, you know, studying biology in undergrad, I was thinking of, you know, what do I want to do when I grow up? And I started reflecting on, you know, that was really interesting. What was that homeopathic medicine? So I decided to study, you know, pre-med. I got my Bachelor of Science in Biology and minor in Chemistry. And I came across and heard about naturopathic medicine. And so I started researching that. And I attended some, you know, conferences on homeopathy. And I met some naturopathic physicians who graduated from a school out in Seattle, Washington called Bastyr University. So I applied and I went there. I said, this is neat stuff. You know, they talk about how the mind's connected to the body, and that's got my journey. I graduated 4 intensive years later. It was full-time, including summer. Got a clinically supervised training there. I graduated as a doctorate in naturopathic medicine, got licensed as a naturopathic physician in Washington State, and we moved here to Raleigh.
That was pretty straightforward for you then in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Preeta.
Yes.
Yes. So now tell us your story.
Well, my story is a little different. I was born in Africa, but I'm East Indian Hindu in religion.
Right.
So we practiced Hinduism for many years. And my first introduction to naturopathic medicine was through my grandfather. And he was a traditional devout Hindu, lots of rituals, lots of prayer. And my grandmother was ill at the time. She had very serious diabetes. And I was about 5 years old, and he would always hold my hand and walk me through his garden because he grew his own vegetables and fruits and particularly herbal medicine to help my grandmother get better. And through him and my mother, who always treated us using Ayurvedic medicine, which comes from India, it was just a natural part of our life growing up. We would never take drugs unless we absolutely had to. So we used that a lot. But what was interesting is that my mother would always use prayer as well to help heal us. You know, she would also say, I'm going to pray over you and, you know, pray to God that you'll get better. So I grew up using Ayurvedic medicine, and we very rarely use drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And my epiphany came actually when I was in undergrad school. I was in England doing physiology, and we learned how the body worked in disease and wellness, and I wanted to know, well, how can we get the body back from disease to wellness?
Right.
So that's how I got into naturopathy, you know, meeting various people on the way.
And actually, naturopathy is more mainstream in Europe and in England than it is here in the United States, folks.
Right.
Very much so.
Yeah. So, I mean, even the Queen Elizabeth herself has known that she has a homeopathic physician.
That's correct.
Yes.
So just
there's homeopathic hospitals in England.
And in India.
Yes.
France and Germany is very large botanical medicines, herbal medicines, and homeopathic.
Yeah, so you know, so that, you know, what might seem a little beyond the pale for American medicine, which is very deeply invested in allopathic medicine, What does allopathic medicine mean anyway? you're the physician.
Well, I think that allopathic, you know, it's Latin. Allo means like other or opposite, uh-huh. And pathic is, you know, pathology, disease. So it's an antagonizing the disease. The approach is, you know, typically, you know, drugs or chemicals.
Fight the disease rather than figure out what the symptom is.
It's suppressing symptoms, you know. Yeah. There's anti-inflammatory. I call it the anti-medicine because anti-inflammatories, you know, it's against the inflammation, which is a healing process of the body to bring blood there.
Yeah, so you see symptoms then as a process of the body trying to heal itself.
Exactly. Well, I see symptoms as clues to help me figure out, you know, what's the underlying cause of the illness, what's really going on.
Yeah, let's be highly simplistic for argument's sake. If someone has a tumor, which is a serious thing, and the tumor in itself is the body trying to heal itself of whatever it is that it's trying to do, at least initially. The symptoms of the tumor are that.
Mm-hmm.
So, recognizing that, you would think, do you see yourself as antagonistic against an allopathic medicine, or would you be willing to, if somebody came in with cancer, you know, they probably would want to deal with a cancer physician too, but could you see yourself in cooperative with mainland medicine or what?
Right. I see my role as, you know, complementing, and it's really the allopath could be, well, let me put it this way. People can be on their medications and still, you know, use nutrition and stress management, you know, meditate, get exercise, use herbal medicines. There are some precautions, you know. Some herbs do have strong effects and can antagonize other drugs.
Right, right. So you have to be cognizant of what that stuff is, what's going on there. But that's college you went to. You had a pretty thorough study in pharmacology and other physiology and a lot of things.
It's a naturopathic medical school. We're trained in all this medical sciences and diagnostic lab testing, X-rays, and we do order tests. We do diagnostic testing. There's many saliva tests, for example.
Yeah. You know?
We read and understand, like, a CBC, complete blood count.
Yeah.
So that's how we can understand and dialogue with your medical doctors. And we request medical records if necessary.
Right. Yeah, Preeta, you wanted to talk a little more about your spiritual journey towards your homeopathic physicianhood.
My naturopathic physicianhood? I was fortunate to have many epiphanies along the way, and while I was in naturopathic school, I got familiar with the treatment called craniosacral therapy, which really opened me up mentally and spiritually in conjunction with homeopathy. I mean, these treatments work really well together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously going through medical school, you have a very hard time because it's very intense, and you kind of lose yourself a little bit along the way as well as you're growing. And craniosacral therapy was very calming and relaxing to me.
So is basically cranial sacral therapy massaging your neck?
Not quite.
Not quite.
So. Now, cranial sacral therapy is a type of body work that's very light touch therapy. And what we're looking for is a cranial sacral rhythm in the body, just as you feel a pulse, to figure out how well or how well the heart's beating. It's the same thing with the craniosacral rhythm. We feel how well is the fluid flowing around the brain and spinal cord. And so what I do is I look for restrictions in that flow and use manual techniques to release that. And thereby you calm down the nervous system, increase circulation, help with detoxification.
Yeah, and the way how do you determine that rhythm? Do you put your hand on a person's spine and around their neck and skull, base of the skull?
Absolutely, yeah. Craniosacral really means cranial, which is the head, and sacral, which is the tailbone.
Right.
And what I do, say, in the beginning would be to cup my hands around someone's the back of someone's head mm-hmm. and just very sit silently with them and just feel their rhythm. You know, is it symmetrical? Is it fast? Is it slow? How is it flowing? Is this person in distress? Mm-hmm. So that's how we feel it, by just very silently sitting with that person.
And then moving around depending upon what
exactly
what if you notice it's a slow versus fast and so forth, balanced or imbalanced or however.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So apparently, according to the leaflet you gave me, what are if somebody were to consider doing something like craniosacral therapy. What would be what are the kinds of things that people have that would this might be a useful therapy?
Craniosacral therapy treats a wide range of people's symptoms or conditions. The main one for me is people who need stress relief if they have high blood pressure. I see a lot of clients who have high blood pressure, and this is wonderful for helping them relax mm-hmm. and also in their stress management protocol. But there's also certain conditions like orthopedic conditions or TMJ problems, neck pain, back pain, physical conditions as well.
TMJ for us who aren't part of the medical establishment.
Is the temporomandibular joint, basically problems with your jaw.
Okay.
She had a really interesting case recently with a boy who had facial tics. And she used craniosacral therapy, just two sessions, and it's been more than a month, and he hasn't had any. And they occurred, I think, daily.
That's fascinating. It is,
right,
stuff.
Because there's restrictions, you know, in the cranial and facial bones that can cause those things.
And it also says here, the people who have chronic back pain, migraine headaches, chronic fatigue, central nervous system disorders.
Exactly.
Yeah. Learning disabilities. Gee, I should have come to that for a long time ago.
Right. I mean, children who have attention deficit uh-huh. disorders, craniosacral is wonderful for calming the child. Mm-hmm.
And so part of it then is you're sitting there and sitting with them, but then apparently there's probably some educative process so the person learns how to calm themselves eventually. Is that it?
Exactly. Sure. We use a lot of calming therapies like meditation, because our medicine is not a fix-it medicine. People don't come to us, you know, and say, hey, fix me. You know, we help people empower themselves.
Right.
We help them. Yeah. We educate them to help themselves. And so craniosacral is like that. We teach people to be aware of how they react to stress. You know, where are they holding their tightness? Mm-hmm. You know, is it affecting their breathing? Are they holding their breath? You know, or are they breathing too fast? You know, are they holding tension in their gut? That kind of thing.
I've prescribed meditation, even for a boy. He's a 12-year-old with attention deficit uh-huh. hyperactivity, and if he was willing to do it and found results, I mean.
Well, was he?
He did. Yeah, I told him to start off, you know, 1 minute a day or 5 minutes.
Right.
This was, of course, meditation. There's probably an infinite method of techniques.
Yeah.
The one I suggested and taught him was an alternate nostril breathing meditation.
Mm-hmm. So you breathe in with one nostril and out with the other.
Right, yeah, you block one nostril.
Yeah.
It's calming and it kind of balances the two hemispheres of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's just to become present in your body. And people find, you know, they have more clarity.
Yeah. For you religion junkies out there saying, what are you talking about naturopathy here for, Paul? You use Reiki also in your practice, which Reiki is an initiatory healing, meditative, and spiritual path that I assume began in Japan. But why don't you tell me about Reiki, since you're the practitioner?
Sure, that's correct, Paul. Reiki did arise out of Japan, and Reiki can be broken down into Rei and Ki, you know, which is universal life force energy. And basically, if anyone's interested in doing Reiki, they get initiated or attuned to the power of Reiki,
mm-hmm.
Through various attunements in first degree, second degree, and master level Reiki. And basically, it is a spiritual practice because it's almost like a spiritual laying on of hands where you allow this universal life force energy, this love, to come from the universe through your hands to help that person heal. So it's a presence kind of therapy,
mm-hmm.
where the person's laying on the table fully clothed and you're just gently laying on your hands and just sending them love so that their own healing processes can take place and you're enhancing their healing abilities.
I could see how these various therapies like the craniosacral therapy and the Reiki therapy could easily bleed into one another without necessarily being distinctive. You know what I mean? I could see where if you were gently holding someone's skull in your hand to see it balances, that the Reiki energy would just naturally flow at some point. It'd be pretty hard to keep this stuff straight, you know.
It's a lot of overlap.
It's like all the waters from different rivers all flowing into the sea. You know, it's kind of hard to keep them separate.
Right. Well, you know, mind, body, medicine.
I mean, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a connection, an interconnection, interplay. They all affect each other.
Yeah. In the New York Times, of course, I'm not going to remember the author or the title of the book, but this last Sunday there was a book written by a well-known physician who basically was writing, you know, why do Americans seek alternative therapies? And, you know, and naturopathic medicine is definitely an alternative therapy in an American parlance. But the recent, and she went through this long thing and did the long history going through New Thought, which is a form of American metaphysics that developed out of spiritualism back in the late 19th century. And she went through all these things, and the Quimby thing, and Mayer Baker Eddy, and various forms of mesmerism and hypnotherapy . And basically, she said, well, basically what we're trying to do with this is we're trying to, you know, bring our disease or our discomfort into our story. And we're trying to then story our way out of it, you know. And normal medicine doesn't give us, like a technology that, you know, seems alienating and we're just sort of plugged into it like a, you know, we don't know exactly what's going on.
Yeah, there's passive. You fix me.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to come in.
Yeah, my car doesn't work, you know, fix something, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my heart isn't working anymore. Give me a new heart, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know. Exactly.
Yeah, with naturopathic medicine, you know, people want to take an active role and they want information and education and be empowered to make more choices. And there's, you know, every day we make choices. That is a great power, you know, what foods to eat. Some are healthier than others.
Mm-hmm. And now another part of your practice is naturopaths is diet.
Right, yes, nutrition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a great deal of issues. So what are some of the basics of nutrition? I assume you're not telling everybody to follow the pyramid.
No, we definitely individualize it, personal to what your needs are. And what your conditions are, but yes, nutrition, which is obviously what we eat and drink, but also there's nutritional supplements to, you know, make up deficiencies or just to optimize your health and balance to your different body systems.
So you are seeing it in a prescriptive manner. If a person comes in demonstrating certain symptoms, you're going to suggest.
Yeah, there's therapeutic doses of single nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, and we're always encouraging people to go more towards a natural whole foods approach compared to processed foods.
Right.
Right, because they're less chemically toxic to the body.
Right, so yeah, you're not dealing with, you know, strange pesticides.
Exactly, additives, preservatives.
Yes, that.
I'm always happy for people to, you know, eat their vegetables even if they're not organic.
Yeah, that's right. Roughage is good for us, right?
Exactly.
Let's see. So how did you, Fred? How did you discover Reiki? When did that fall into your path?
Well, that only happened 2 years ago, and I discovered Reiki because I'd heard about it, and actually was very skeptical about it, even with my background. And despite my skepticism, I decided I was going to go ahead and learn more about this. And as I got into Reiki 1, I was completely hooked because there was something to this. And, you know,
you immediately felt whatever the energy was.
Exactly. And through the attunements. But also, I experienced a Reiki treatment myself. Mm-hmm. And, amazingly, helped me heal that particular problem at that time. And so I thought, oh, there's something to this. And, you know, it went back to my mother praying over people and just sending love to people. That's very powerful, that there's support out there for someone.
Yeah, and by the way, people, you don't need to be initiated into Reiki to pray for somebody.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. It's available to all.
It's available to all.
You can't leave that home.
Yeah, and you know, and there's no, probably no, you know, I mean, we all think, well, you know, how do I pray? You know, I mean, do I just say something? Well, if the only way you know how to get a hold of your energies is to say something, then say something, you know. But you know, but if you can direct your energies in other ways of feeling, feeling something, saying, "I feel love, and I feel that the goodness and health and wholeness is going to come to this person."
Right. Yes, our intention.
Yes, it's powerful medicine.
I mean, I think every thought is a prayer. Mm-hmm. It's intention. It's what you're focusing on.
I think
intelligence.
I think you're moving back to your Germanic roots of Pietism there. Thinking is thinking. Thinking is thinking. You know, I don't know. I don't know how much you know about your Germanic roots, but Germanic Pietism was a profound influence. Though they in their evangelical fervor, they cut themselves off from their alchemistical. Origins, and with Paracelsus, whom you probably heard of in medical school, he was definitely a naturopath and for his day, and also was part of this Pietist movement. The Pietists got a narrower, more fundamentalist view of things over time, and cut themselves off from there. They also, in this country, the Moravian Church, which is a local church that has deep historical roots in North Carolina and Virginia, the Moravian Church, they had a profound sophiology.
Oh, okay.
Which is, you know, this evocation of the, not only of Mary, but actually of the Holy Spirit. But the Holy Spirit is our loving mother. You know, that the immanence of the Holy Spirit is the divine mother energy of the world, you know, which is coming forward again. But it took, years of people, you know, for this sophiology, to this theological roots that were, go back to pre-colonial America to come forward and to say this, mainly because these folks that when they moved over here, they continued to speak German and wouldn't, and so they wrote all this stuff in German, and it never got out of German, you know.
Right. Well, another German is Samuel Hahnemann, who's the founder of homeopathic medicine.
Yeah.
He was a medical doctor, and there's,
and when did he live? He lived in the was
18
about 200 years ago.
About the end of the Enlightenment, about 17 something to 18 something.
Yeah, I think the
early 19th century. Yeah, that's about right. So.
But yeah, you know, he had concepts, spiritual concepts relating to medicine. They call it the vital force.
Oh, yes, Odile.
Yeah, it's your vitality.
Hans Reckenbach and Odile, right.
It's like invisible energy, or it's that which is present in all living beings that, you know, helps you balance and heal.
Yeah, in another term that was used besides the odic force, which is this life force that we sort of emanate, that also speaks. You know, there's we've had people on the show that do aura photography, and to what degree as naturopaths do you deal with? Well, you deal with this energetic pulse that you mentioned with the cranial sacral thing, but. Do you also deal with auras or a sense of how a person sort of emanates? Is there anything like that in your practice? Pushing you at the metaphysical edges.
Well, you know, I you know, we don't do aura photography, but sometimes you can feel a person's energy.
Right.
Or, you know, they give you permission for their thought processes during cranial sacral, which can be very intuitive.
Yes.
Because we all hold memory in our body. And sometimes people, if it's traumatic, want to release that memory. And so in that way, you can get more towards the intuitive, spiritual side of things.
Yeah, it is amazing having experienced roughing at one time in my life, which I would rather not return to.
Brave man.
Yes. Well, it's just a form of early body work, which attempted to release the memories, but they sort of did it in the traumatic sense of of realigning your body, whether it wanted to go that way or not, and it could be pretty painful for a few weeks afterwards. But the, you know, that one of the things is, as we live our lives, we carry around our stories with us, and there are sort of like undigested aspects of our story of things, of pains we felt, of sadnesses that we've held, and we sort of put them away. You know, and they stick there, you know. And they,
in storage.
In a sort of storage.
Pandora's box, right.
Yeah, and they stay, stick in various parts of the body. It's amazing, all the parts of the body that can carry around different kinds of memory. And when you start to, you know, at some point we just get full. You know, maybe it's called aging, but we just get full of this stuff, and we haven't learned how to let any of it go,
or we start listening to it again.
Yeah,
and be willing to feel it, and or be willing to, you know, see what the value there. Mm-hmm. You know, I know, sure, pain by definition is kind of that which we don't like, we want to avoid, but it has a lot of great benefit.
So in some ways, facing the pain is not as painful as avoiding it, in a way.
Right, it's like lingering.
Yeah.
I'd rather address it instead of let it linger on and then cause more problems down the road.
Yeah, so that it's sort of like, it can be a quick misery now or a, you know, lingering, chronic, you know, the lingering misery for months and years afterwards,
right?
You know, chasing you down to the grave or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So basically, letting some of these things go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So why don't you tell me some other interesting cases you've had in terms of the kinds of things you do? That'll be fun.
Well, I do focus. I do specialize in children's natural health.
Yeah.
I like to see a lot of behavior disorders, but I see, you know, common infections, you know, ear infections, including those infections vaccinations are supposedly preventing.
Uh huh.
For example, I had she was about a 2-year-old. She had measles. And she had been vaccinated, but she still had measles. And I gave her a homeopathic medicine that matched her, you know, her behavior symptoms with her physical symptoms, the rash, the cough, and, you know, she's fine in a week.
Yeah. Now, actually, yeah, let's explain that a little bit to our audience about homeopathic, which basically is where you, if somebody has a rash, you give them something that would, or very minute something that would cause the same kind of rash, right?
Right.
And if they have a cough, you give them something that would cause a cough. That's like to like. That's homeo means the like to like.
You know? Right. Exactly.
It's not a form of homosexuality, folks. That's like to like too, but in a different way.
Right.
So why don't you explain a little more about that?
Well, homeopathic medicine, it was founded over 200 years ago by Samuel Hahnemann. And it's a system of medicine that is comprehensive because it's the mind-body. It looks at your connected and interconnected with your emotions and your mental state as well as your physical characteristics. And we address your constitution, which is your vitality, your tendencies to, you know, what's your weaknesses and strengths. And it uses natural substances, you know, whether from plant source or minerals or animal. But they're very diluted. And it's non-toxic and it's very inexpensive. And usually the dosing is very infrequent too. It's not something you take every day. And my main emphasis, why I'm really jazzed about it, is because of all those reasons, and because it's very safe.
And also, you know, what you were saying earlier, Paul, is people have stories. And in homeopathy, we want to listen to your story. So we want to know not just your symptoms, but really what makes you happy, what makes you sad, what makes you angry. You know, what are your favorite foods? We want to get to know you as a whole person, not just your physical symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to know your story.
Gave me a 20 questions. This is from the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians, which is in Seattle, Washington. And I'm going through, we've actually covered a lot of these things in a sort of relaxed way. But one of the things that it does say here is that is how inexpensive and infrequent dosing is. In other words, in other words, if I want to get high, I shouldn't be coming to you guys, right? Is that it? You're not going to give me my opiates for the week,
right? No.
But I guess you would prescribe opiates for something, wouldn't you? Well, I guess if somebody
was
sleepy a lot or something, you give them a little opiates to wake them up. I don't know. Okay, I'm just giving you a hard time. All right, go on.
I was just going to say, since you brought up opiates, there is a homeopathic opium, but of course it's extremely diluted, and there's no original, molecules of that left.
Mm-hmm.
But it is used, for example, constipation.
Well, okay, let's say you had somebody who came in there who was an addict of some sort. Let's talk, I guess the worst forms of addiction that are floating around now have to do with people who take too much methadrine. I don't know if you're going to run into too many cases like that, but probably. But, you've got somebody who's, seriously whacked out as far as their system goes, using some seriously terrible things. Now, we're talking very broad hypotheticals here, folks. So this is not, this is not free prescription time. But how would you approach that case?
The first thing that I thought of was detoxification.
Yeah, yeah, obviously, which might be pretty hard to do with. In some cases with the stuff, the detoxification can kill you, depending upon how you deal with it.
Right, how severe.
Yeah, how severe the addictive aspects of the drugs are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what on methadrine, what kind of detoxification. It's such a heavy-duty and destructive form of intoxication.
Well, sometimes, medical intervention is necessary, and, detox is an important component of that. But, also finding out while that person is an addict, what makes them want to turn to something outside of themselves to make them feel good versus from within themselves.
Yeah.
And, we use adjunct therapies. You could use homeopathy, nutrition, in a very gentle manner.
Right, and there's herbal medicines that improve the function of the liver. There's antioxidants for the liver. So the liver is one of the main detoxification systems of the body.
So obviously you have to deal holistically with the actual person rather than, one size fits all.
But right. Yeah. We like to say we treat people, not disease diagnosis.
Yeah.
Of course, we make diagnoses, but it's not a simple cookbook approach. You have this diagnosis, and there's the X list of treatments. Because we always personalize.
Yeah, and I guess if something doesn't seem to work, then you would try something else, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, depending on, So that's why you spend a lot of time actually talking to your...
Yeah, the more we know, we get to more, the more we can help you.
Yeah, so a good part. So if you go to a naturopath, you're going to talk about yourself, I guess. Initially, say, here I am, and this is who I am, and so forth and so on.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. If you think about going to a medical doctor, you basically wait for a while, but then when you see the doctor, it's about a 7 to 8 minute visit.
Yeah, at best, yeah.
Versus naturopathy, we're seeing you for 1.5 hours, and we're getting to know the problems that you're having, but also getting to know you so we can form a whole picture of who you are as much as we can in the time that's allotted to us.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of your own practice, I assume you see people in the spotty way. You know, the people, they come and see you when they have a self-diagnosed problem.
Yeah, I wish more people came in for prevention, but sure, just about everyone's, they have a current condition they're concerned about.
Yeah, and that gets them there. But as you said, you wished you saw people more for a preventative thing. So this would be seeing people on a semi-regular way, like every year or so, depending upon what their conditions and stuff were.
Well, the great thing, you know, helping people with nutrition and stress management, you know, those are therapeutic for current concerns, but they're also prevention for future problems.
Yeah. Now, one of the things we were saying in our pre-interview, as much as it was you mentioned that you were active in the local Buddhist community for a while, or at least attending that. Is that the case? The Karmapa Center? You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Preeti and I were studying with the Kadampa Center. It's a Tibetan Buddhism in Cary. And, studying their meditation techniques and... I find it's very, you know, spiritual, emotional, mental, all those things interlinked to me.
Yeah, and actually in Tibetan, Buddhism has an Aryavedic tradition in itself. They call it something else, but for instance, the Dalai Lama's physician is a naturopath, isn't he? I believe he is, isn't he?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, and actually I think I saw a show some years ago. Some PBS special in which the Arya, the physician of the Dalai Lama, and a couple of other physicians who were naturopaths, Tibetan Buddhist monks, went and did a diagnostic treatment on three women who had cancer, three women who had breast cancer, and each of them were given completely different, lifestyle change stories. In other words, neither of them were exactly the same. They were given completely different modalities. And the one who was diagnosed from the point of view of the cancer physician had the most relatively benign and most treatable cancer. This is at the time of the initial diagnosis and complementary medicine. Mm-hmm. She heard what the Dalai Lama's physician was, you know, and he basically told her stop drinking coffee and so forth and so on, and she didn't do any of it. She, you know, she wanted to have her cafe latte in the morning and so forth, and her cancer got worse, and it got malignant in a way. Mm-hmm. And whereas the other ones followed their prescriptions a little closer than and they had, you know, they had reasonably, and they were working with both physicians. I mean, they were working both the classic cancer therapies, and they were adding this naturopathic ones, and they got a little better. Mm-hmm. And the woman who hadn't followed those prescriptions, she said, "Well, you know," she says, "I just thought I could, that it didn't matter that much, drinking that cup of coffee just didn't matter that much, she was." Seriously, concerned that, suddenly her cancer had become a lot worse. And you could see that she was really upset from the interview that was going on. So, I think one of the other things that, which is true in orientation with around this show, which is spiritual experience and religion or religious experience, is that, part of it is the essential, the empowerment that I don't know what you would call what some of us call God, because I tend towards a Buddhist attitude there, which is slightly agnostic. Mm-hmm. But there is something, I probably have a bias that the universe is ultimately good in a way, or has the potential of being ultimately good in a way, at least in this little envelope of the earth, this little biosphere that we live in here, and that it can work with us and will work with us to sustain a reasonable life if we learn how to work with it. And that's part of it. That's a spiritual empowerment. And obviously one of the extensions of spiritual empowerment would have to do with you know, physical and mental and, you know, biological environment, that if, you know, if our bodies aren't working right, then it becomes important that we find a way to, you know, get along with
right.
ourselves.
Well, certainly, yeah, if we're feeling pain, then it is harder to be and feel compassionate, or just a simple feel grateful, gratitude. That's another prescription is gratitude.
Back to his pietist roots again. Yeah, thinking is thanking. Gratitude's the attitude. The attitude of beatitude.
I think spiritual empowerment also comes from being friends with nature. And that's where naturopathy comes in, because we use nature as our healing power, as our healing force.
Yeah, and you know that the nature of our nature is, the nature of our culture is nature, right? In other words, we aren't that far removed from our little, you know, from the natural world, you know, and it's only a conceit. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a number of conceits like this, you know, that we're above, you know, our culture is above nature, our human life is above animal life. But, you know, but we're learning and we're getting zapped hard in a way that, you know, that all life is precious, and that we, and that the preciousness of life is that we partake of that life. But that life is not any different than the life of a dog or a, you know, or a rabbit or a microbe. You know, microbes are the real biotic. You know, livingness of our of this planet. You know, if there weren't microbes, we wouldn't live. You know, we live because of microbes. You know, we are collections of microbes. You know, but actually, it reminds me of a story. For give you guys a break for a second, as I used to do. What's it called? Come on now, Paul. It's where you, you know, sit with people when they're dying. What's it called?
Like hospice care?
Yeah, hospice. Right. I was a hospice volunteer for a while. And one of my guys that I used to, they always used to give me the guys that were dying that had been drunks all their lives. And one of the guys told me one time, you know, he said, well, he says, you know, there really ain't any difference between me dying and a dog dying. I said, man, I said, that's profound. You know, it's really great, you know. Mm-hmm. I said, you understand that we're all that evil. So I thought it was a wonderful insight, you know.
Precious.
And so I mentioned it to one of the healthcare nurses, and she said, gee whiz, that guy sure had a low sense of self-esteem. I said, I didn't notice that. And I didn't notice that he said low sense of self-esteem. I said, maybe a little humility, but not any low sense of self-esteem. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know. But
he shared that with you.
Yeah, it was a sharing experience. I think I was probably right in my interpretation of it rather than than the low sense of self-esteem issues. You know, coming to the wisdom of understanding that we all share, that we share this sort of living
connection,
veil, living connection. You know, I think it's one of the things that that fuels animal rights movement, you know, and particularly when it comes to the wanton cruelty that we inflict upon the higher animals, you know, our rats and dogs and cats and, you know, animals that we, I don't know if we share feelings with rats so much, but we definitely share feelings with dogs and cats. They're our pets. And we keep them with us as an extension of our emotional field, in a way.
Right. We consider them family members.
Yeah.
Many people do.
Yeah. And so so if you get somebody comes in and they're allergic to their dog or their cat, that would be a good one, actually, because there are a lot of people who suffer from, dander sensitivities. There are obviously ways to intervene with that, isn't there, naturopathic?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so you got any other good stories to tell?
Well, I remember my very first client who came to see me, this was in 1998, my very first patient, you know, here right. I am raw out of medical school.
Right.
And she came in and she couldn't even finish the visit in the first 5 minutes because she was terribly ill and she had to go to the bathroom and throw up basically because right. she was in so much pain.
Right.
And, you know, she had gynecological issues and through nutrition, you know, herbal medicine, some homeopathy, you know, we got her back on the right track to where she didn't have so much pain. So she came back the next day, you know, we used a whole lot of that and part of her problem was that she couldn't get pregnant, mm-hmm. you know, because of the issues she was having. And, you know, within 6 months of natural therapies, she did become pregnant.
Became pregnant.
Yes.
And carried to term a nice little...
And that was my first case. that was very interesting for me because she was in a lot of stress and a lot of pain and she actually turned her life around, did right. a lot of stress management because a lot of stress was causing her pain.
Right.
And infertility. And so, you know, getting back on... She empowered herself to get back on track.
Right.
And was able to have a child.
Well, that must be incredibly... what's the word... thrilling to see these
profound changes in people's lives.
Yeah, yeah, and that you're there to assist. They assist with this this possibility. Mm-hmm. I think what's your website for folks who have been listening to this and who may want to consult with you about something? Do you have can you say what your website is?
MyVitalTouch.com.
Yeah, so that's M-Y...
T-O-C-H...
Vital.
All right. M-Y-V-I-T-A-L... T-O-U-C-H...
Yes.
.com. MyVitalTouch.
MyVitalTouch.com. And this is your practice, which is sort of in the Raleigh-Durham area, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Off 540.
Off 540. And let's see. So I noticed, Tim, you didn't, when you were telling your story, you didn't, did you have any religious background at all in your life? I'm
born and raised Catholic.
Oh, you were born and raised Catholic?
Right. Every Sunday, you go to church, very, serious about it.
Are you still practicing, or are you, I don't know what the word is, lapsed or non- non-observant.
I actually attend, it's called Journeys, it's a spiritual community mm-hmm. in Raleigh.
Yeah.
It's a multidisciplinary, eclectic. It's talking about wisdom
right.
from whatever tradition or religion, whatever source, you know, whatever works.
Wisdom is another word for Sophia, folks.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So you're definitely digging up your Pietist roots there, aren't you? Yeah.
We have teachings from Buddhism or Christianity. Whatever wisdom to increase joy.
So it's what's this group called again? Journeys.
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 Mm-hmm.
And what is it? How organized is it? Because I might want to get somebody on and talk about that particular thing sometime.
Yeah, sure. It's organized. It's a nonprofit organization.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we meet every Sunday at the Raleigh Elks Lodge off of Millbrook.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it began 3 years ago.
Wow, so it's relatively recent, and it's mm-hmm. Local?
Yes, it's local, right, in Raleigh.
Is there a charismatic leader?
There is, Bull.
So who's your charismatic leader?
His name's Bill.
Bill? Bill, the charismatic leader? Good. I'll get some information from you after this
sure.
show, and maybe I can drag Bill down here and he can speak for himself rather than instead of having a bunch of, as it were,
personal experience,
misattributed views. Yeah. But how did you stumble into Bill's thing?
Website surfing.
Website surfing?
Mm-hmm.
You found out there was just Journeys things going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also a website, huh?
Right.
Web address is off the top?
Just in case. I think it's journeysaspiritualcommunity.org.
And you can just Google Journeys and Raleigh.
Journeys in Raleigh, and you probably find something about that. And this way, folks, you guys can check it out before I get them on here on this show.
Mm-hmm. Life is a journey. We're each on our journeys.
Yes. So, I guess life is a journey. I you know, in terms of metaphysical metaphors that float around all the time, that one is more acceptable to me than life is a schoolroom.
I hope not. Four walls.
Yeah.
Sit there and be quiet.
Somehow the you know, we're all here to learn something, and as soon as we learn it, we're going to die. You know, I do understand how that works though for some people. Another story I can share with you has to do with when I was in college and I was studying this stuff. I was doing suicide prevention, counseling over the phone, and I was taking a class being taught by Jacob Needleman, who's was a well-known gadfly. He's a Gurdjieffian and a professor of religious studies at San Francisco State. And he had a class called The Idea of Tradition, which is the traditionalist viewpoint. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not. But basically it says the traditions, meaning all the great religious traditions like Catholicism, Orthodoxy, and the Vedas, and they all carry around a deeper understanding of life and things than we have access to in the West. You know, we're sort of superficial and gadget oriented,
materialistic,
yeah. And so I had to give a talk on this, and the very next day, and so I was spending an all nighter at the suicide prevention, and I got this person called up, and she was dying. She was a 19-20-year-old woman who was dying of a brain tumor that was inoperable. And she, you know, went through incredible phases of pain and so forth. And for her, she really wanted to be independent of her, you know, family, her mother and her father. So she had refused to tell them that she was dying because they would have immediately infantilized her. And she wanted that little bit of independence she was going to have. You know, she wanted to have her boyfriend, she wanted to have her friends, she wanted to have her independence for the little while that she had, but she didn't really have much of a prognosis. So she used us at suicide prevention as a way to get through the hard times when she was got very afraid, very alone. So I talked to her for a few hours, that the wee hours of the morning. You know, and in a way, I lost all sorts of, you know, sense of composure at the time, in the sense that I knew that who I was listening to was somebody who had more to teach me than I could ever, than me being just who I was, right? You know, there was, no, you know, the theory of suicide prevention is that there are emotional pains that we haven't released in a way that can kill us, and they are killing us emotionally, as they can kill us physically. And by the way, if you feel such terrible depressions at times where you feel that whatever guilt or whatever thing is so terrible that you should die, one of the ways that you could treat that is through naturopath. And you could go see a physician, and they can help you get over those terrible sense of self-loathing that makes you feel that the only way out is death. But
absolutely. And you are precious.
Yes, you are precious, and that your life is precious, and that you deserve every bit of your life. Well, she, who didn't have much life left, she died about 3 months later, actually. There were other counselors who did more overnighters than I did, and they finally told me that she'd passed on. And I think I'd only had two conversations with her, but this was my first one and my longest. And you know, but one of the things she said is, so I said, well, what are you learning? You know, this, you're consciously dying in a way, which is, you know, so can be a gift, you know, for some of us.
You know, sure, it's
most
a
of us run
motivator.
Around and deny that we're going to die until the last moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, what was your thing? And she said, you know, I just learned that, you know, some psychic told me that, you know, it makes sense for me. She said, is that, you know, that I'm here to learn how to love, and now that I know that, I can go on. I can be at peace and go on. She says, that makes sense for me. So I went back to that class, you know, the one about tradition, you know, where the tradition said, and I said, well, I said, it may be true that the traditions claim they have something greater than we do. But I said, we're greater than the traditions. We've got the secret within ourselves, folk. It ain't lost. And nobody's got a dime store monopoly on it. Mm-hmm. We are the precious, with our own selves, of the preciousness. Mm-hmm. And it kind of what you're saying in your own way is that you're empowering people to find that preciousness, you know, to find that there's something really beautiful and powerful in themselves, you know, that's there.
Exactly. And as far as illness, you have your healing power. You know, we can't give you that. We just help you find that out.
Yeah. I really want to thank you for being on the show today. I kept you here for a good hour talking, and I hope you aren't sweating too much. It was really pleasant. I'm really happy that I was able to introduce you to the wider Carrboro and Chapel Hill community, all three blocks of us. And I'm really happy that you folks out there have tuned in today for this edition of Touchstones. I'm your host, Paul Nagy, and you have been listening to WCOM, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. We're at 103.5, your community radio station. Communityradio.coop. So thank you so much for having been here, and we'll see you next week.